Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Word is proud media partner of Latitude Festival. For more information and to purchase tickets, go to www.latitudefestival.co.uk.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
And this evening, you say it's a drinking thing.
No, tonight I'm just meeting a friend who served a couple of decades at Warner as the head of Warner Country. He's a Brit and a very nice fellow, Andy Wickham. He produced a couple of records for me. We're getting together, and so being in London is like a great reunion for me. We have a friend, my wife and I, a friend by the name of Penelope Tree. We've known her ever since, I mean, for a long time, and she's also one of the big mavens of the pop era, you know.
Maven is a great word, isn't it?
Whatever it means.
What does that conjure up, a maven?
Well, to me, it's like, it's under that category, think British, speak Yiddish, or no, it's the converse, that's right, yeah. Think Yiddish, speak British.
But there's something kind of slightly supernatural and immensely powerful about a maven.
And she was. She was one of those figurines that decorated the pop era. When we're talking about the 60s, and I don't think the 70s really existed. Except for a little disco.
Well, we're going to get to that in a moment, because I wanted to ask you just a little bit about each section of your fantastically illustrious career. Starting with, I suppose, our first sighting of you was in the 1950s. For some reason, I think, in a film with Grace Kelly, that happened?
That's right. Alec Guinness, I would use that name, because he's a very fine fellow, and showered me with a great paternal affection, sending me Christmas gifts for the next 5 years after that. He was a very kind man. And
how did you finish up to be working with
him? Alec Guinness, I tell you, Alec Guinness epitomized to me what it is to see an artist achieve some degree of notoriety or celebrity, but celebrity was not the beast it is now. And, you know, people are clapping at the American president. And so people go into the office, that their people are clapping for him. He is a servant. He is a servant of the people. And not to be clapped at. That's ridiculous.
You should have been at our royal wedding if you wanted a dose of that.
Yes, but that, you see, but this is a different thing. This is America supposedly stepped from monarchism. And now you see what rock and roll has become is monarchism light. It's, to me, it's the same thing, but in different clothes. It's the worship of celebrity.
And that presumably has a negative effect, you think, on their artistic
output? I think that it has a corrupting effect, but when I knew Alec... When I worked with...
Dear boy.
When I worked with that great actor, I saw such modesty and such fluency, too. You could go to a restaurant, sit down, have a bite to eat, unmolested. Now people I know who are so famous, they can't go out and buy their own clothes. They can't go to a restaurant. I know people like that, that are so confined by this, the punishment of celebrity. I haven't had that problem. I have just a converse. I've stayed like in behind the curtains for working in music for so long, and I have the blessing of anonymity, except when it comes to things like Union Chapel on May 16th, when I'm trying to fill every pew, and I have a phobia about empty seats. But I mean,
the
I don't.
Exorcism. We'll talk about that at the end because you've got to plug that. Yeah, the exorcisms you described it earlier on.
But.
But going back to your career, Grace Kelly, I mean, give me some indication of what that was like. And how old were you at the time?
Well, can I ask you that? I have a picture of it in my, let's see, that was, I was 12. 12 when I posted my way across the screen on the horse. And she side-saddled, much more difficult and to do. And but it was an amazing adventure. That was 1955. I was there the day Disneyland opened. I remember that. I've had an amazing life around people of great talent, and I've also sought it consciously, like in the music that I do. I've sought being with people that I thought had superior gifts, and to try to. And I believe it's been a life of reflected glory.
And well, that's extraordinary, honestly. Yeah. But you managed to find yourself in close proximity with, well, actually via a group, if I remember right. You started with your brother. Am I right to think your brother wrote Something Stupid?
He wrote Something Smart. I've written a lot of stuff. He was a one-trick
pony.
Something
Smart that made a lot of money.
But it was a very good trick from that pony, and it served him well.
You did, your group, I think, was called Steel Town 2.
That's right.
And then you changed your name to Steel Town 3.
I
love things like that.
Now.
It's like Spinal Tap, isn't it? It's so sweet. I mean, I'm assuming that's not irony.
No,
you know,
it was
the Thompson twins. There's actually three of them. You know,
it was fun. We used to call ourselves Los Tres Dos. We had many names, but we went through the...
You were a folk group then, weren't you? We're talking about the very early 60s now?
Yeah, there was serious world beat kind of concentration. For Mexican boleros or huapangos or sambas. And, you know, I remember the first night Esther Gilberto across the street from our club in Hermosa Beach, she came to Howard Rumsey's Lighthouse. The first night I saw that 24-year-old Brazilian, she was singing... Girl from Ipanema.
Fantastic.
And I was just, I saw her first night, and I went across there. I was 20, but they let me in anyway. I was supposed to be 21. And after the show, she went off the stage, and she went back to the kitchen, and she was just sobbing because she was so frightened, you know? She was from jet lag or whatever it was. I don't know if they came up on the jet, but she was definitely under duress, and she was just sobbing. I went in there, and I was 20 years old, and... 21, that's right, just 21. And I was going to console her. I was in love with her. Of course, I was in love with her.
Why wouldn't you be? You're only human. Yeah, absolutely.
I love that beat. I'd never heard anything like it. And she was just so feminine and so, you know, downright companionable. But when I went in, I saw she was in...
What a sweet word. No, companionable.
When I looked at her, she was so beautiful. And yet, I didn't speak any Portuguese. So I couldn't speak her language. And this was an older woman. She was 24. I was a mere 21. There's a big age gap there. So I thought, what am I doing here? This woman is not going to get any comfort from me. I better leave. But you see, it's just an illustrated point. I've seen a lot of different music. I've been interested in basically world beat or roots music of all kinds. Doesn't
How
matter.
Did you get to work? Actually, you know, I haven't introduced you yet, have I? I'm very rude. This is Van Dyke Parks, the good great. Listeners. The great Van Dyke Parks. I'm so thrilled that you've come along. We are both, aren't we, Fraser? Yeah. Enormously thrilled.
Well, I'm
It's a real privilege.
Really
we've got
touched,
quite
guys.
A lot of interest, I have to say, a huge amount of interest from we'll have to get some of their questions later from our... from our listeners to the podcast. But just another question, again, changing tack. Didn't you work on the very early Byrds records as well?
I did, yeah. But so 1963, Bob Dylan came along freewheeling. Then we had the Stones, 12x5, which got Britain into the transportation of the blues. The blues were bottled. That was the year that we started the commodification of the blues. They were bottling the blues. So that started in 63, the Summer of Love. Surfboards went styrofoam, so anybody could carry one. I was among them. I lived in a beach town in California. Beatnik elements and coffee houses. It was like a very beautiful experience for me. Then the Beatles hit the fan. Everything started going into rock and electrifying. And that's when I got the clue the Burning Bush, you know, and I did not want to join a group, but I did play on that first Burning
Bush. So you
saw
which way the wind was blowing.
Absolutely. I stopped playing a nylon string guitar, and I took the beta position of a keyboard player, and that got me into a recording studio with people like Ry Cooter and Paul Revere and the Raiders and many, many B-movies later. Many acts, some of whom were prominent, others that were imitative of the Beatles or so forth, but generally...
And Crosby wanted you to join a group. I think he actually tried to form a group with you before the Byrds, right?
That's true. But David, once he saw my brother and me, and he said in his autobiography, he saw my brother and me in a coffee house in Santa Barbara, and he said, he turned to David Lindley, another musician.
No, I met David.
And he said, he looked at David Lindley, he said, referring to me and my brother, he said, if these guys can get away with it, so can we. So he said that was the moment he decided to do what I was doing at that time. And I was just delighted to see some corroborating
How would you describe what you were doing? What was that?
Well, it was world beat. It really was. What I was seeking to do was lose my virginity by singing beautiful songs in Spanish or French. And I did that. I achieved that goal.
I was so pleased. Every sense, obviously.
Made a lot of sense to me at the time. And yes, it was. And it was folk music, certainly. And I mean, like, I memorized maybe 50 solos from Mexican boleros with my requinto. And I played Indian harp, and I worked real hard. And I had a guitarrón, which is a fretless bass that you hold. So I was under the impression I was in a Latino culture when I went to L.A., which I was. And I explored the music and had a ball. And then everything turned out to have the rock sensibility prevailed. And then... I worked basically behind the scenes from 63. I did the Bare Necessities for Jungle Book by Walt Disney. That was my first arrangement.
You arranged
it was called the Bare Necessities.
Oh, yeah, we know
and,
very well.
And that was the song from this movie. And that was my first job in with a union, a check.
That's astonishing.
Yeah.
And what did they see? Because that's a very high profile position. What did they see in you? Why did they think you were capable of doing that?
Well, to tell you the truth, the man who wrote the song, he knew that my brother had just died. My brother was a foreign consul to Frankfurt. My brother died in the Cold War as an espionage. And my brother and I did not have the money to go back to the funeral or have a black suit. So this man gave me a job knowing that. Terry Gilkison, who wrote the song, he gave me the job out of compassion. And we went back and put our brother into the ground. But I knew that was, as I say, a burning bush.
Had you any idea that film was going to be so huge?
Oh, I had no idea. I had no idea. All I knew was it was a great opportunity. It wasn't an elaborate arrangement, but it was an entry for me.
Did you ever meet Louis Prima?
Oh, I met Louis Prima.
Sang King of the Jungle song.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And Phil Harris. And Thor Ravenscroft, zippity doo dum, zippity yay. That bass singer. I met all these guys. So I was in heaven. But then I went ahead and worked in the studio. And I did it so anonymously that my mother once said to me, she said at some point when I was a brunette, my mother said to me, she said, Van Dyke, my husband and I love my father. She said, we've always marveled that you put your retirement in front of your career. Because, in fact,
lack of ambition.
I was working very hard, but, you know, I'm thinking, you know, working on music and doing arrangements, and I love that position. I loved the position. Going up about 1969, I loved the idea of arranging for Ry Cooter.
But Ry Cooter, but I don't want to miss out the Beach Boys. I mean, I've personally got enormous interest in them, and I know a lot of people listening have. And you know, you were asked to write the lyrics for Smile, when you said at this point, the Beach Boys are phenomenally successful.
Absolutely, top of the heap.
What was, to Brian Wilson, it was an ambition he could choose anybody. Why did he choose you?
Which is funny to me, because really, truly, Brian was, to me, he was the Beatles and George Martin. He did all of those jobs. And so I was
very well put.
I was astonished by him. And we just happened to meet. And the only I had written a song, which It was called High Coin, and then I wrote this song, and it had some, in times of wonder from down, when times and places effervesce in words of wonder from down under, I'm no less, I'm fine. It's my time. So Brian heard this song. He saw that I was working on songs, and he needed a lyricist. And also think that strategically, he realized that the Beach Boys had been comfortable in, like, pardon the expression, bougie. It's what my daughter called bourgeoisie.
Oh, right, bougie.
A little bougie, a little Eisenhower-era comfy chair, kind of like right. Passé. And Brian, I think, in one fell swoop, wanted to get somebody who was decidedly counterculture. And he didn't know that I was counterculture as well. I was so counter anything.
A little bit bougie like
him. I was counter. But I believed in a lot of the things that Brian. Well, there were things that we shared, in our youth and wonder, such as the hymns, a love of the hymns,
yes.
Barbershop, confirmation. To me, and you look at the Smile cover, the Smile that the original art.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, will be used in this new box set. I've held every configuration of the Beach Boys Smile, which is coming out this year, I think in September. When I go back, I'm going to write some notes on it, which is very nice for them to have asked, because, of course, I felt that the whole thing originally I thought was a disappointment because it wasn't released.
Well, we're going to come to that. Let me just ask you one other thing. I mean, the kind of cliched historical version of the story is reduced to a competition with the Beatles. You know, the Beatles, it's Revolver, then it's whatever.
Well, I understand.
Then they come back.
I understand.
And is that true? I mean, do you think that's
absolutely.
Probably true? Because
absolutely.
The impression you get, folk rock historians will tell you, that they've served their trump card. They've played their big card, which is Pet Sounds, and they're sitting back thinking, follow that. Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band comes out.
No. But I must remind you of an incident.
They're gone.
Just to let's get the timeline here.
Yeah, yeah.
The timeline is that the thing called Smile was in progress. It was on 8-track at Armin Steiner's studio, 8-track studio in Yucca and Argyle. That's where the studio was, and that's where the tapes were, and that's where the Beatles came to review Smile in progress. Brian Wilson continued to work on that. And the Beatles, who shared a publicist by the name of Derek Taylor, he was the first man to call Brian Wilson a genius. That was an ad campaign. He called Brian Wilson a genius.
Possibly a bad move.
I think it was very intimidating, and I think it was not. And I did not think that it had a long range benefit.
But
managed to intimidate Brian. But I wouldn't have done it. But anyways, the point is, Derek represented both camps, and I had heard at the time that the Beatles had been in there and reviewed the irregularity of Smile. They heard what was going on, and
what do you mean by the irregularity? You mean the diversity?
Music? The music is different. It was different from anything.
Different from what they'd done before.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, and that ranked my groove, as they say in Mississippi. That ranked my groove. I didn't like that at all. And we felt very competitive about it. And then the Beatles...
When you say reviewed it, so had Brian, was this on Brian's invitation?
No. Brian did. We didn't know a damn thing about it. So they
Derek allowed that to happen?
Huh?
Derek had allowed that to happen. Derek, sure.
Derek and I were... I loved Derek like a brother. Derek called me to invite me to his funeral. Called Los Angeles to ask me to come over for his funeral. He knew that he was about to die. I thought I just got off and the phone and just had to sob about the man.
No, I met him, an amazing man.
Sense of humor and great personality and a lovely man. And he was the guy who wrote that campaign that said, "The Beatles is coming," which is just like the R.J. Reynolds, "The Camels are coming."
That's right.
In World War I, see, all these people, they got the cigarette habit because of that campaign, "The Camels are coming." So Derek co-opted that, and that's part of the success of the Beatles.
But just quickly, going back to the story, so the Beatles are allowed... To listen
they,
to,
yeah, they heard some tapes and
works
I tell you,
in progress.
Right, they
of
heard some
Smile.
Tapes, right, and then they, with great alacrity and a sense of purpose, they went back to England and they nailed the damn thing. They got the Arab in the limo. They got their thing done. It was called Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
And what was Brian's reaction when he heard that?
Oh, well, it was devastating, but because they did it.
But he wasn't devastated because he thought any of his own material had been lifted.
No, but
he was devastated by the sheer quality.
There was a degree of youthful hubris in it. They had done that. They had captured that degree of absurdism. When I came in to your fine studio and I saw Fraser's card, there's Frank Zappa. Now, Frank Zappa was an absurdist.
Yeah.
So I'd already been down that road. I'd trod that tread.
Van Dyke is holding up, in fact, viewers, Fraser's own card, which has the cover illustration from Word with Frank Zappa on it. Superb. That's your calling card, isn't it?
It is.
Go on, Frank Zappa.
So I'd heard music that was kind of, outside the box, and didn't bother me too much. But there was that degree. Both Sgt. Pepper and Smile, obviously, in their inception, were going to ask a lot of a loyal audience. They were going to take an audience into an entirely new area.
They were a challenge.
Yeah, a challenge for an audience. And of course, I don't think when you work, you're not thinking about what is somebody else going to think about this. I think you have to be true to yourself. I think artists do. They should. That should be a part of that they should show courage and the powers of self-reinvention. And that's.
But it all falls apart. I mean, Cabin Essence turned up, I think, on 2020. Surf's Up finishes up, obviously, on Surf's Up. Heroes and Villains is on Smiley Smile. I mean, piece by piece, the material that you made was issued, but it was never issued until quite recently.
No, it was all an apology for it. It was always tremendously equivocal. And until.
So why, just going back to the game, why didn't the record come out? What's your version of that story?
Well, I don't have a version. I have an aversion to aversion. because, honestly, but truly, I do. I have an aversion to it because it was obviously that people in the group and the promotion man from Capitol, who were decidedly hitbound. If you listen to the music of the era that prevailed, it's pretty. It's a mile wide and an inch deep. Most of it is not memorable.
Right, but it can't be an A&R decision to not put out Smile. It must be Brian's own loss.
I don't think so. I think that it was the system itself failed. I think Brian was on track about it, but. What's interesting to me now is that the amount of work that is revealed, and this is something that I haven't heard it. When I go back, I'm going to hear it. I said I would like to listen to it first. It's three vinyl records, three LPs.
And you've not heard this?
No. And I just think that it's a wonderful piece of work because it is not the property of its authors. It's the property of people who intervened and reinterpreted it and pirated it, which, of course, drove me to distraction. I would have preferred to have a Bentley and a pool in back. but that was not to be.
But your bicycle is parked outside.
But I got it, and so
tell me about. Funny enough, the last week we had, was it last week? Neil was in. It was, yes. Neil Tennant of Pet Shop Boys, mm-hmm. And I asked him a very corny old question, but it always interests me, which is, was the greatest song ever written? And his decision was, well, he had two actually, Alfie, didn't he? By Burt Bacharach, and his other was Heroes and Villains, which is a fantastic coincidence because you were coming in this week.
Yeah.
Now tell me about how did you work with Brian Wilson?
Alfie's a great song too.
It is a great song, but we're not going to. Yeah, okay. I'm sorry. I'm not going to let you.
Burt Bacharach. Take
now that I've got you. Here. No, just. I want to know how the working process was. How would a song like that?
Well, that song, he just played the song, and I immediately provided the words, and we did that in about 4 hours. That particular, except there was a bridge that was later on about some cantina section they used.
When you say immediately, so you already had an idea?
No. Music. He played the song and it sounded like a ballad to me. I mean, ballad in terms of like what we think of in country music, a song that has a through line or something, a miniature, a story. It tells a story. It reminded me very much of that same Marty Robbins El Paso type of thing. And I wanted to, and in Lit 101 in school, in literature, they say the first thing you do is write what you know. And what I knew was that I had come to California and I had this impression of the Southwest, and I wanted to capture that in that song. Wanted to do what I did. So I thought doing through the art of cliché, as it were, and I do believe there is an art to cliché, that it should be used powerfully. Bear in mind, this is the same time people like Roy Lichtenstein or Andy Warhol or Robert Rauschenberg in the visual arts, pop was big.
Absolutely.
Pop was real big. Even,
huge bright colors.
Yeah, and even like
cartoonish
pop art and cartoon consciousness. All of that was in the visual arts. It's just natural that it was in Smile. I mean, it was music that was struggling to become something of its own and have a really contemporary kind of transparency to be part of what was happening, that close to what was happening. Not something that was safely, it was not to recite old victories, musical or otherwise. It was just to go somewhere new. And so that song, Heroes and Villains, came within hours. And every word, I've been in this town so long that back in the city I've been taken for lost and gone and unknown for a long, long time. I fell in love years ago with an innocent girl from the Spanish and Indian home of the heroes and villains. Once at night, Cotillion squared the fight and she was right in the rain of the bullets that eventually brought her down. But she's still dancing in the night unafraid of what a dude'll do in a town full of heroes and villains. Every one of those words was a note. So I never once suggested that we lose or gain a syllable for my own convenience. And everything just by honoring the melody, the house of cards started to rise.
Fantastic.
And that was, it was an act of God. It was really, pardon me for using the God word. That's just to like, that's to just kind of like explain that I wasn't in charge, but I was very fortunate to be where I was at that time serving that man who was so talented and I think that his youthful, is the fact that his ambition didn't outreach his ability. The song delivered on a major front, and that's where we started.
But I find that stuff so fascinating, because you think of the combinations of lyricist and musician and how difficult it is sometimes to make those two things compatible.
Well, it is.
The lyric might come first, the music might come first. Yeah. One's not going to budge, one's not going to give.
Well, in those cases, music was always first in those cases. The music followed, the words followed the music, and that's which I thought was my obligation to him. And that's why he bought me
a
Volvo.
And you really, I'm seeing a smoke-filled studio late at night, and you were sitting there writing this in pretty much one take in 4 hours.
No. That was in broad daylight.
This was right, but it was a 4 hour.
This was in broad daylight. And this was just to get acquainted. I mean, I went up to his house on Summit Ridge Drive. We went up to the house and wrote the damn song. To make sure everybody understood that we were going to get some business done here. I was going to faithfully follow. Beach Boys legacy with the loyalty of a dog. I was going to work hard and become a lyricist. Of course, I didn't know what a lyricist was supposed to do. I had no idea.
Again, what a huge advantage.
Yeah. So I was amazed and as I still am by the creative process, because I found out some people have asked me questions relating to songwriting, because it's my favorite. I mean, it is my obsession. That's what I do. I either write songs.
I would expect it to be.
Or I try very hard to frame other people's songs with orchestrations or arrangements that don't draw too much attention to themselves, but support the artist.
But Brian must have been thrilled with the fact that he's built this kind of this sonic confection, which as a young kid, when I heard this stuff on the radio, I was aware, even at a very young age, that it seemed superficial.
Yeah.
And it was lyricists like yourself that brought this new dimension to to the concept of the Beach Boys.
Well, it's, you
it
know,
gave it a kind of depth, and it gave it a kind of minor chord.
It's a funny thing too that it did have. It's like they had a serious musician. It was a serious musician. His name was Edgar Varese, and Varese made up this thing called
Frank Zappa's Great Hero.
Yes,
who Frank Zappa rang on his 16th birthday.
Well, I understand.
It was his present from his father.
I remember stuff, and he the music concrete. Was this tape-to-tape sensibility where you just cut something off and go into something else, and things were highly interruptive and anecdotal. Schumann, once Robert Schumann in the 19th century, talked about things like that when he would call it an evaporation. Things would evaporate. And I love that word. So this is what Brian was. He was not afraid to do that. He was very deceptive. You notice that happened in Good Vibrations, where it slowed down in the middle.
Wonderful.
It slowed down.
Absolutely.
And you looked at
different
it,
movements.
At an adolescent dance show on TV, and the kids are stopped. They don't know how to dance them. Promotion man said, oh, this is my worst nightmare. I was with a Capital Promotion man.
The party's ended.
When they started, yeah, when they stopped dancing, they were confused. Well, they got used to it, and eventually people decided that the song was worth its salt. And so I do that, by the way, much differently, not so celebratory, but as I reflect on heroes and villains, I put that in the show, because it's very much a part of my life.
You put out various terrific solo albums, your song cycle, Discover America, and, you know, we wrote a piece actually recently in Word about the advertising campaigns in the 1970s that very much supported mm-hmm. the idea of the immensely credible and critically well-reviewed artist who didn't sell. Yeah. Now, you didn't enjoy enormous sales, but you got an enormous amount of applause from those in the know.
It was, to me, the opportunity. I made all my mistakes in Song Cycle. But then again, and I think...
What mistakes were those?
Oh, well, they, of course, they are obvious, but the thing is filled with thought. It's filled with thought.
Is that a mistake?
It can be, but there was. But the thing is,
should have a sticker on the album. But that, filled with thought. But warning! That, but, warning! Yeah, warning! Filled
yeah,
with thought.
Yeah, no thought. Yeah, it's what Zappa used to call the mind police came in.
That's right.
They came. The mind police. They came in, and started to tear it apart. But the fact is, years later, you know, I went up to a hotel room. I was invited by the harpist, Joanna Newsom, come up here and listen to these songs. I did. She had a harp. She rented a harp in the hotel room. I went in. I took my wife so I wouldn't be alone with this lovely young woman. I didn't want to give her the idea that I wanted to jump on her, which, of course, had occurred to me. It might be more fun than talking about work. But work is not
I
the answer.
I can't see the attraction myself.
right. But at any rate, but to be quite serious, I turned after her and said, "Well, I want to do the whole thing. I want to do the record. I want to do the whole record." So Joanna Newsom was very delighted, and I turned as I left, as I was at the door. It just occurred to me, I must know. I said, "Well, what did I do that interested you, Joanna? Why am I here? Why did you offer me this job?"
Fascinating.
Why do you try? I thought maybe she heard a U2 record or Rufus Wainwright or something. She said, it was Song Cycle.
How wonderful.
And I thought, you know, I just wanted to weep. I thought, you know, this is so beautiful that a young modern, from a contemporary artist, generation away.
23 or whatever she would
have
been.
Yeah, that I was migrating to another generation, that I would serve another generation of musicians. And it just... it touched me deeply.
No, I'm quite
so
sure. I can understand
I'm
that.
Not so pressed to get immediate approval on things, but I think it is okay to just continue to put the shoulder to the wheel and allow the jury to arrive in time. You know, not press for
Absolutely.
Immediate approval. But I've had a great adventure on each.
Well, let me ask you about, we had all day for this, because this is absolutely fascinating. The various people that you work with, just some impression. Can I just give you a couple of names?
Yeah.
You made a record with Lowell George, or you did certainly...
Lowell was a genius. He was like a brother.
Spanish Moon. Yep.
And Spanish Moon.
Tell me a bit about him.
I'm putting Spanish Moon on my sampler I'm putting out a CD arrangements I've done with
Excellent.
Different artists, from Bonnie Raitt and Lowell George and various people that I have enough cheek to call it Volume 1. part un. I should have called it Part Un. But I didn't call it Part Un. I called it a Volume 1. And that's coming out as a CD, along with the downloads of my new singles will be available in a couple of days on iTunes. But putting out some stuff.
But Lowell, so how does it work? You're walking into a studio and there's Lowell George in there, and he's looking for horn arrangements. What's the next step?
With Lowell, I loved Lowell's work, and He had very interesting. First of all, Lowell's favorite blues musician was Howlin' Wolf, as was mine. And Howlin' Wolf was I was born in Mississippi, so was Howlin' Wolf.
Unmistakable voice. Absolutely unbelievable voice.
And to me, he was the greatest of all the blues musicians, the most innovative and incredible powers of deception and so forth, and emotive force. Well, Lowell loved this guy, too. And Lowell, as a matter of fact, had later on been in the Zappas, as I had. Didn't stay long because he had other things to pursue, and Lowell went...
When you say in the Zappas, you were...
In the Mothers.
You were part of the group, weren't you?
I was in the group, yeah.
Did he give you some kind of name, or did you...
He gave me the name... my name was Pinocchio. So, and I felt like I was at a bad boys party. I did.
Which album were you on? Were you on an album?
Didn't make an album.
Is it a touring
album? But I just, all I have is, to corroborate this, is a few musicians. Jimmy Carl Black, as a matter of fact, last year, he was the Indian in the group, but Jimmy Carl was living in Hamburg, and he called me and asked me to join a tour. They were going to have a tour called The Grandmothers of Invention. And I just couldn't do it. I'm sorry. That was a little too rough and tumble for me.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So, I mean... but another person who was in the Mothers, who was still alive, is Elliot Ingber.
Oh, great, yes.
And he said, recently he said to me, he brought me a bottle of wine at Christmas last year, and he said, you know, we could never understand. Just one day you stopped showing up. We didn't know what happened, you know.
I didn't like being called Pinocchio.
No, I didn't mind. I enjoyed the experience. I learned a great deal. But like I say, what I learned was I was with a man who was totally without fear of going out of the box, you know, and...
Was he as ruthless as made out? I've seen film of him. I'm fascinated.
Oh, yeah, no, he was a very angry man.
And it's just extraordinary, the detail, where when he auditioned people, he would often only get people who'd been Academy trained for a start.
Yeah.
And then he would give them absolutely impossible music.
Yeah, no,
music or then make them play it and make them play it up a quarter tone.
Beat them up. No, definitely. He knew how to do that. He was always rank display. He was a leader, but he did that. He demanded a lot in his degree of abstraction. But you see, I've always felt that the idea is, in spite of my bad boy reputation, I've always wanted to play on accessibility. I've never wanted to leave someone in a puzzlement. I mean, there's a last.
No, I was going to ask you that. I can really sympathise with that, because it must be very hard to be in a group like the Mothers or the Magic Band and put all that effort into being one tiny cog in a giant jigsaw that is somebody's own personal fantasy.
Yeah, yeah.
And as you say, is partly designed to leave people perplexed.
Yeah,
and,
yeah. Well, you know, I want to tell you something. There are three kinds of people in this world. There are people who can count, and there are people who can't count. So, and I rest my case, okay? And I hope that that
I
will...
I didn't see that coming.
I hope it'll help. Because
that's
we need
so good
stability in this world. Post George W. Bush, we need stability.
Look, this just in. Sorry, Ben Grabham just tweeted this. I'd love to know more about helping produce Randy Newman's first album. Went on the staff at Reprise.
Well, it's his best. Yes. It's his best album.
Tell us about that one.
Well, I saw Randy last night at Jules' show. Jules, somebody.
Jules Holland. Holland. Yeah,
show.
Later.
There
yeah.
was Randy and there was Brian. Now,
oh,
they're
fantastic.
Two entirely different guys. I thought, you know, why go? You know, there'd be like two minds in search of a single thought. Why should I go see these RTDs ready to...
With thought.
You know, what? You know, I just didn't... But I realized I was very happy to be there to see this show, and the music was incredible. But the Randy Newman in answer to this gentleman's query, and thanks for the thought, Randy Newman's album was a marvelous thing. I told Randy last night, I said, you know, I went through the piano bench. I have a piano that came into our house in 1911, March 11th. It's been in our family over 100 years. And I found that I had stored an arrangement to Vine Street, which is a piece Randy wrote for me, slightly biographical, biography light. And in it was the imposition of the Beethoven Ode to Joy.
Yeah.
Quotation is, dee dee da 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 da. And that was on Vine Street, on the word Vine. And Randy last night reflected of how happy he was that he said, I thought that was the best assignment writing I ever did. I said, I believe so. And I said, I will give you that manuscript if it'll mean a damn thing to you. Would you like it? And he was just...
Have you still got it?
I have. Oh, yeah. And it's the work of a 24-year-old, which is absolutely... as impactful. Clear as glacial ice, as yeah. clear as anything, every decision is perfect. And there it is in this penciled work. And so it will go back to its author. But I've had it many years.
How wonderful.
Yeah, and he was delighted. I was so happy that I could meet him. See, I don't see him too much. He's pixelated pretty well. He works a lot in films.
Pixelated. Well, I mean, he's, expression.
Well, I mean, with the pictures and so
absolutely.
Forth. Absolutely. But pictures a lot. And basically is hermetically sealed. He's a very... a social misanthrope, I would say that he would agree with that. He's a person who likes to be alone and miserable.
Yes, and he gets a lot of very good music out of
but
it.
But I have
he makes he's the original grumpy old man.
I have an entirely different philosophy about the whole thing. My mantra now is I've suffered like hell for my music my entire life.
It's your turn.
Union, maybe go to Union Chapel on the 16th of May.
And that is the concert that you're playing. Beautifully sung. Thank you so much. And described earlier as an exorcism. It's at the Union Chapel in Islington. And what will it consist of? I think it's you and a trio, isn't it, Van Dyke?
I am being... joined by Claire and the Reasons, who are a quartet. I'm having a guest cameo. Ed Harcourt is coming to.
Oh, wonderful!
And he's a lovely fellow.
Brilliant piano player.
I just wanted to see him again, and I asked him if he would, you know, make me feel like add to the hospitality. So there's that, and then I will have a trio back me, and we're going to make a dust.
Give people some clues as to what songs you might be playing.
Well, I'm going to play some songs that I have written from the get-go. I'm going to do I'll do a song from Smile. I'll do a song from Song Cycle, one or two songs from every album I've done, plus songs which I haven't recorded that reveal that I do have aspects of... being old and in the way, being disgruntled, being less than satisfied
Randy
with the
Newman-ish.
World we've got. Well, Randy Newman made an old man out of me, and it's enough to make Stevie Wonder. Take off that tutu, Desmond. Take off that tutu.
Thank you so much for coming in. Absolutely delightful. Lovely to see you. Thank you.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
Magic. Look at the state of you. Have you actually been to bed?
Not really. I had a bit of an incident last night. I went to see Pete Doherty in Shepherd's Bush, and I think he's got this kind of...
Is that a personal visit, or were you watching him performing in a band?
Yeah, I was watching him play, and he was, I have to say, he was shambolic at best. And I'm quite a long-time fan.
You would
fan.
Have been mortified if you hadn't been, surely?
Well, it wasn't... He seems to play in his foibles now. It just wasn't good. I mean, he just didn't seem to be able to play or sing properly, and... you know, hold it together at all, really. It was just him and an acoustic guitar, and, you know, you're obviously really open to the elements. You've got to be good on your own. But if it was anybody else up there, they wouldn't have got away with it. He just sounded like a junk bloke in a pub.
But presumably he played to an audience of adoring acolytes, 100% of them looking exactly like him, who applauded loudly his every move.
Yeah, I felt quite the other one out, actually. I was expecting to... you know, to be really taken about. I saw the Libertines last year and I was really impressed with them. But, no, it wasn't 6 out of 10, I'd say. A bit disappointed. A bit
okay, flat. 6 out of 10 sounds generous, actually, from the review you've just given us.
I used to live in a flat in Kilburn. I've told this story before, but, and it was, I shared it with a photographer, an NME photographer, who'd done a lot of work with the Libertines. And, they were playing in London, and one night I woke up one morning and, stumbled down the hallway and went into the front room. And there, lying on the floor, I'm not going to reveal which one it was a member of the Libertines. His girlfriend. So, that's something you don't see every day.
Oh, my Lord.
Nice.
That's very nice. I once walked up the stairs of a flat in Ladbroke Grove, discovered a member of the Clash, unconscious, clutching a bottle of, is it called mezcal? Is it that tequila that's got a bug in the bottle? Anyway.
Is that a clue to the identity of the person?
It was Paul Simenon.
Okay.
Yeah, but that's exactly what he would expect him to be doing. But now, look, the point is, you clearly haven't slept. Or did you sleep at all? And if so, where?
Well, it's all kind of above board. See, I'm off the booze at the moment. I'm doing a 100-day experiment. So I got home and it was late, but I was perfectly compos mentis, and I thought I brought along the wrong key. So I thought, oh man, I'm locked out. What do I do? And I didn't think to try the door. I thought the Boy Scout in me just went.
And this is you not drinking.
Yeah. The Boy Scout in me just went, I know. I'll sleep on the trampoline. It's soft. So
it's what we all do.
That was the only rationale for it, really. So I got on the trampoline and sort of tried to wear my bag because I was a bit nippy. I tucked everything in, so I tucked my socks into my trousers and my T-shirt into my pants and just became this giant onesie and sort of slugged it on there for a little bit. And
so when you turn over in your sleep, presumably there's a great lurching sensation and
it was a bit uncomfortable.
You're virtually doing a somersault.
I've got a man bag and I tried to wear it because I was getting a bit nippy and I was wearing this little tiny denim jacket. Which is not meant for boys. And so I was getting a bit of draft, so I tried to put on my bag, as you do. But it wasn't really working out for me, so I didn't really get to sleep for, well, ever, really. But then I heard this rustling in the bushes, and I was a bit tired, you know. I got a bit paranoid. I thought, oh, my God, what is it, a fox or a badger or a snake? And I was going through my head what it could possibly be, and just kind of sitting there thinking about what I would do if I was suddenly snared upon by a fox or a badger or a wildebeest. And all those scenarios ended in me either running away or ninja kicking them. There was no real contingency plan. And I kept sort of making myself big at varying intervals just to let this creature know that, you know, I was a human being and I had some sort of perceived hench and it shouldn't, you know, mess with the big man. I think I staved it off.
You never discovered what it was?
I didn't. I like to think it was a bear. Okay. But I've got no conclusive.
What part of the world are we talking about? This is High Wycombe?
This is Braintree.
Braintree in Essex?
Yeah.
Good God. Wild Braintree. Now, the point is, you've seen Pete Doherty.
Yeah.
You've had absolutely no sleep. You've kept a wildebeest at bay. You've slept on a trampoline. You're barely with us. But I'm still going to ask you to generally big up and promote the three favourite tracks on the CD. Why? Actually, there's a picture of the staff. Where is it? Here we are. And tragically, you don't appear in it. Here we are on page 7. You're being held in a framed portrait, lovingly, I think, by Nick Nack Schilling, our office manager. Where were you on that day? Why weren't you? I can't remember. You weren't there, anyway.
I was snoring my head off in a car between Manchester and Oxford, with Left With Pictures, I think when I was taken. So it's my in memoriam photo, isn't it?
It does look as though you and Juliet Cromwell have passed away. Rather sad, you've been held in rather respectfully in these framed pictures. But you were touring with the band, wasn't it?
Yeah, we had a little mini tour. So we did Manchester on the Wednesday. Then on the Thursday, we travelled down to Oxford.
Which band was it?
Left With Pictures.
Oh, okay.
The Twee Chamber Pop Fellows.
Oh, yeah.
But I slept all the way. I just
Chamber
just
Pot or Chamber Pop?
Chamber Pop. I do a good line in Chamber Pots also.
I can sing in the wind. Okay. But look, here's the record. It's got 16 tracks on it. The 16th, I will fill people in on in a moment. But out of the 15 musical tracks, give us two or three that you think are particularly worth people's time and attention.
Well, my first pick would be a track by Little Barry.
Oh, right.
One of my favourite bands.
Oh, didn't I choose that as well? I think I did.
You did?
How exciting it's gone there.
A cracking band. I've loved them for years, and they are indeed fronted by a small chap called Barold, and they play kind of
Barold. So Barold, that's right. Yeah.
It does sound like it should be short.
It should be, doesn't it? Yeah, it does. Yeah.
They play a very, very decent brand of modern blues rock with a twinge of soul, and I've liked them for years and years and years, and this is off their third album, I believe. It's got a bit of a Motown edge to it. It sounds really, really, really good.
And on drums, Steve Howe. Is that right? The son of Steve Howe, rather.
Yeah, Virgil.
Dylan Howe.
He's
Which way? Which spelled not Dylan?
No, it's for, I think Dylan's Wilco Johnson's
That's
drummer.
Right. Sorry, he's got two drumming sons.
What a family.
Incredible,
what a
ridiculously
isn't it? Talented family.
It is. That's absurd. How fantastic. So that's Little Barry. So what others? Give us another a couple of ones to look out for.
Another fave would probably be the sorely missed Polystyrene.
Oh, yeah.
And this is her comeback album, Generation Indigo, and it's a nice slice of gutsy synth pop called Kitsch, which is. It's very good. But obviously, she passed away shortly after.
Passed away very suddenly, actually. Yeah. I was very knocked back by that because she was, in fact, down to do an interview with us on the Friday.
Oh, really?
So she was obviously... No one was aware, including herself, of how unwell she was. Very, very tragic. But that's great to have her on the record. Fantastic. A track called Kitsch. And one more. Give us one more.
One more.
Sounds like proper radio, this, isn't it?
Last one is going to be Orchestra del Sol. It's a track called The Doppler Effect.
Oh, that's a great record.
I think you first flagged this up, actually.
Yeah, I love this record.
It's brilliant. It's got accordion and trombone, and anything with accordion and trombone on it, I automatically like. So it's just a winner because of its what's the word? It's makeup. That's two words, isn't it?
Likeability.
Yeah, it's got immense likeability. It sounds like a chase. It's a sonic manifestation of some kind of chase.
Good. In fact, and also what I love about it is it's Balkan, isn't it? There's a Middle Eastern kind of klezmer sound to it. And I thought these guys, I wonder, fantastic. Where are they from? They're from Scotland, aren't they? Yeah. all of them. So it's all in there. Celtic music. It's Latin. What do they call it? Honk step.
Honk step.
I believe they call it. Honk step. I think. So that's that one. And the last track, which I must just tell you about, it's fantastic because anybody listening is, by definition, someone who's genuinely interested in our podcast. And there is another podcast, unavailable on the site, only available. You see what we've done there? It's very clever.
Cunning, it's an exclusive.
It's an exclusive on the CD. And we're calling it the Notcast. And it consists of four of our regular podcast contributors, I think, addressing one single question, which is, who is the most impressive rock musician you've ever met? And they are, in no particular order, the voices of David Hepworth.
That has been pointed out by many people that he's the only person you go and see where you get the whole story. You get soup to nuts. This is what rock music is all about. There'll be some amusement, there'll be something serious, there'll be something experimental, there'll be something mad, there'll be something political, there'll be something religious, whatever. Yeah. Mm. And it'll add up to this vast, great narrative.
Myself?
Yeah, he's talking about living in Los Angeles, you know, and his next door, he bought the house from Gregory Peck, he had Jack Nicholson two doors down, he had Ryan O'Neill, he had a man who he described only as Sharon, or Mrs. Mercury, who was Freddie, of course, and Elton John, who he called Doris, you know, and he just thought, this must be fun.
The mighty Kate Mossman.
Yeah, he was sat up on this little table so that he was automatically the same height or higher than anybody who came up to him. And basically, we were all made to assemble into a very orderly queue.
It was like going to see Father Christmas in the garage.
Yeah, exactly.
And of course, Paul de Noia.
I went up to his hotel room, which was massively dishevelled, and this blonde woman, herself massively dishevelled, was picking up her belongings and leaving as I was coming in with my tape recorder.
The Word, a magazine, a website, a podcast, a way of life.
So, look, Kate Mossman has joined me, and very importantly, we want to plug the fact that this is the 100th edition of The Word. You've worked on how many? About 40 of them? Over 40? I've worked on 100. Thank you very much, Fraser.
I'm going to applaud as well, because I haven't
do
worked
applaud.
On 100.
Anybody listening who feels they ought to applaud, do join in.
I've worked on, 39?
39.
49? I don't know.
And there's a picture of all of us, really funny looking. We look rather stiff. And, some people already... written in, subscribers have already have a copy of the issue and complain that you know, the office is too is too tidy
and too untidy.
Obviously too untidy. That's right. Yeah. And but they are, I think, I hope, enjoying some of the details.
There's the Cookie Monster.
Yeah, there's
there.
A fun firm moose head above my desk, and also a papier-mâché cherub left over from an old Select photo session.
I'm holding a microplane, which is my favourite kitchening. Gadget.
Is that what you've got in your hand? I thought it was some sort of dagger.
I didn't know what that was. I thought that was a kind of a knife of some kind.
That's pretty, you're holding a
isn't it weird to think
we gadget?
I brought it
in specially. I love that.
We thought he had a knife and we didn't question it. That's the weirdest thing.
God, we just all went a bit quiet when we saw the picture.
But what you really have to look out for in this is there's a cunningly photoshopped picture by Jonathan Sellers. He manages to do this in most of our important moments on the magazine, and this one got through press day without us noticing. It's a piece of popular culture. in Mark Ellen's corner, which doesn't perhaps correspond to Mark Ellen's own taste.
Well, actually, it's very typical of him, because it is actually an entertainment concept, indeed a franchise, that I loathe and detest. And what he's done is he's managed to Photoshop this into a frame. So it looks like I actually have, permanently, by my desk, a framed picture of this particular concept. I know. And I just couldn't believe it, really. But he's done it, and there it is. So there's that. And there's fond memories of... God, I forgot we'd done them. We've had all 100 covers.
It looks amazing.
It does look quite good, doesn't it? And there's all sorts of stuff. And also the failed covers. I love this.
I've got a tweet here from H. Malcolm who says, what's the most embarrassing thing you've published in 100 issues?
Okay. Gosh, that's a tricky one because there's so many to choose from. I'm almost automatically going to say that it was the Dido cover. But, which I have...
Jack Johnson with bare feet.
Jack Johnson. Was Jack Johnson on the cover? Yeah. He was, wasn't he?
No shoes.
Gosh, with no shoes. That was bad. But if you look at some of the rejected covers, I love things like that. I love it with magazines. Actually, magazines very rarely do that, to be honest. I wish my favourite magazines would say, do you know what, sometimes... Because most magazines are terribly... It's all been terribly efficient.
It's been great.
Polished. It's been
great ride,
But we are particularly British and self-lacerating in our
ability.
Each
of these covers, I have to say, is analysed as well, which is interesting.
Oh, that's
They're not just set next to each other. There's a little bit of analysis on each one, which makes for about a month's worth of reading, I think.
And there's a picture here on page 12 of the cover that we were going to run before we changed... I changed at the last minute my mind and put Jarvis Cocker in a fur hat in the Arctic on the cover.
That one definitely goes out of history,
doesn't
it? And
been doing a terrible time for it. And look at the things we've got here. There's a piece, an interview with Ricky Gervais and Stephen Merchant, which is really strong, I think.
He's brilliant on this kind of thing, I think, explaining why stuff is funny. He does better than anyone, I think.
Fantastically good. It's a very technical interview. I mean, it's not full of laughs, which I like. Mm, you know, it's not some show-off journalist trying to be funnier than he is. That's going to be hiding to nothing. It's him explaining the details and the agonies they went through to get the office, because it's the office's 10th anniversary, the office, absolutely right. Amazing details. They talk about the fact that, you know, they made it deliberately stifling, that the lights were too bright and the colour was turned down to make you feel that awful claustrophobic fog of being in a real office.
That slightly green sheen over
there. It's really fascinating. Talking of fugs, there's the fugs as well. And a great picture of Paul McCartney. Which
very,
I've never
very
seen.
Odd picture.
Extraordinarily odd picture of him in the Mullican tire.
Taken at, we think, about 7 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, I think so. Polly Harvey, that was good. Oh, there's great, fantastic, best and worst. Describe the best and worst.
The best and worst is best worst hundreds. So it's everything from the best, the worst 100 years in history to hundreds and thousands.
50 Cent, 200 motels, that kind of thing.
We've already had a complaint, actually, from...
Who was that from?
It was from civic reenactment of the 14th century society.
Oh, God, the sealed knot bloke, what it was.
Who said that you can't possibly say, this is his words were, you can't possibly say the 14th century was the worst ever century, because although the Black Death killed many people, it did give rise to the destruction of feudalism.
And also, he complained that we said the 100 Years' War was, and as any fool know, it is not 100 years,
it's 116.
I know. We stand corrected. Fair enough. But there's lots of stuff. There's a brilliant piece about the National. That's a great piece. And Big Jim Sullivan and the details of all the wonderful films that we've been... 40 people have sent these video messages. Many of them who listen to the podcast regularly. Archie Valparaiso, K2G, Captain Underpants, David Wright, etc. Hannah baked us a cake. There's a picture of Hannah's
picture
cake.
Picture of a cake.
Oh, my God.
All very touching.
Hugh Laurie. God, there's so much good stuff. Landon Wainwright... There was a quiz. We were going to have a quiz. Go on.
Some unanswered questions. Thrown up, particularly in the review section. What is a gynoid? This is a word that we've used for the first time. It sounds gynecological.
Probably medical. Yes, it does.
What is a gynoid? What did Robert Johnson do to hide his playing? And we don't mean turn to the wall. That's too
right,
well known.
Which again, any fool knows.
He did something else.
And I was going to... Actually, I have a quiz question. I interviewed the cover story of this multiple cover issue. In fact, I suppose, is Keith Richards, who we got an interview with, which I'm very, very pleased with, actually. And he rarely gives interviews. And I went over to New York and spent an hour and a half fooling around with him. And one of the things that... One of the extraordinary things he talks about is something that I've waited 36 years to ask him. because I saw the Stones at Nebworth Park in 1976. And if anybody listening was also at the Nebworth concert, they were supported by 10cc and I think the mighty Lynyrd Skynyrd. He would have loved that.
You see, I know.
You love them.
My ideal concert.
And it really was good. And they played on a giant stage with an inflatable tongue and huge inflatable lips. It was the Stones logo turned into a massive, great blow-up pink pneumatic stage. But key point is that 10cc were meant to come on at 10:30 and the Stones, sorry, at 9:30, Stones at 10:30. And when before 10cc came on, there was an announcement saying there'd been a delay, there was some technical problem. 10cc came on an hour and a half late, by which time people were hurling bottles of warm wee in their direction and blamed the whole of this wait on 10cc. And there was an allegation from 10cc to
is this,
me.
Is this the quiz question?
2 years later. Yes, maybe I should just say the quiz question. You're flaring your eyebrows. I'm about to give it away. That's absolutely right. No, you will have to buy the 100th edition of The Word. Thank you so much. To find out what actually delayed the Stones' performance. And I'll give you one clue, which is it wasn't 10cc's fault.
Yeah.
It's a very hardcore story. And Keith Richards admits to what actually happened, which is pretty entertaining, I think. Anyway, all of that is in the 100th edition, which is out today and available in all good bookstores.
If you've been affected by any of the issues in this podcast, go to wordmagazine.co.uk or apply at your newsagent every month.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.